Welcome to Masala PTI with your hosts, Ravi and Arvind. Pardon these Indians as they take you on a unique and wild ride around the world of sports.
Welcome everybody to a reboot of Masala PTI. It's your host Arvind Srinivasan along with Ravi Krishnan. Ravi, how are you and how does it feel to be on this thing after, I believe, 2.5 years?
That time seems to have flown. Hello Arvind, I really feel that it has been a missed opportunity, you know, from my end not to have kept our momentum going in the pod. 2.5 years feels like it just flew by, but thank you so much for re-engaging, and you know, I think this time around really looking forward to continuing this on and doing so with far more frequency than we have been doing so.
I think we should, and it's kind of a miss on our part to do this after the Super Bowl, because we are usually much more plugged into the fantasy side of things and football. But with that said, let's start right there. What was your final thoughts on the NFL season and the Super Bowl? I know it's a little dated, but, you know, since Mahomes is truly moving towards the GOAT territory, it's never late or never boring to talk about him, I think. So what was your takeaways from the Super Bowl?
Yeah, Arvind, so as most, if not all of our listeners know, both you and I live in the Bay Area, so there is probably a natural assumption regarding our allegiance during the Super Bowl. And I know I'm kind of walking on thin ice here by saying that I do not like or support the 49ers. I still am like wedded to my formative childhood, or not childhood, but formative allegiance to the Arizona Cardinals. So in that sense, the result of the Super Bowl itself was something that I was quite happy about. Two things, as we look back, it's been, what, 4 or 5 weeks, and, you know, memory is not too strong, but I would say there are two fairly strong takeaways that I felt looking back today to that Super Bowl. Number one, there seems to me there is some credence to Kyle Shanahan and his ability to, as they call it, manage games to close out. I mean, his expertise from an X and O scheming perspective is, you know, undeniable. And obviously, I still feel he's one of the top three coaches. But there has to be something to the fact that he's now had double-digit leads in each of the Super Bowls that he's been a part of in the second half, and he's not been able to close it out. So that was something that still, like, you know, sits out. I'm not a big guy to look at or base trends based post facto on very little data, but in this case there seems to be enough data to at least keep that question on as we move to next season. So that's one
I wanted to double click on that. Where think he's going wrong? I used to think he's a little bit on the conservative side, especially with Jimmy G, right? I would be too if that guy is my quarterback. But this Super Bowl, he actually went for that fourth down. Remember that?
Yes.
So even that complaint, it's hard to foist on him this time. So I'm just trying to think where he is failing. I mean, I totally agree with your overall assessment, but I'm not able to put a finger on what in general and specifically in this Super Bowl. I don't know if he was too conservative or whatever, but even in general, I don't know where he is screwing up.
So, and I see here is the problem. And number one, so there are two issues which I would like to mention as a caveat before making my hypothesis. And the two caveats are, number one, I should be very careful in using anecdotal data points as the reason or as the cause rather than just a symptom, right, of what happened. And the second thing is, I'm frankly, my recollection of the second of the three Super Bowls that he's been a part of, the Jimmy G Super Bowl, is very, very bleak. So I don't remember too much of it, but going back to the to the famous or infamous 28-3 Falcons Patriots Super Bowl and this one. The one thing that I was really, really puzzled by was his lack of using the run game in the second half. McCaffrey was doing McCaffrey things. Same way, right. Freeman and Coleman were doing really well against the Patriots. And when you have a lead, right. and that to a double-digit lead in the Super Bowl, where irrespective of whether you're going against Brady or Mahomes, I'm sure even they had to have felt a little, you know, under the gun in terms of having to come back from a double-digit deficit. So your biggest, trump card you have, or your biggest strength, is time. You have time in your favor. So why not milk it more and more and play the traditional ball game? And I feel in both of these Super Bowls, I was just awestruck by the fact that he, you know, there were, I think, three or four possessions back-to-back-to-back where he just kept having Purdy throw on first down and second down versus, you know, running with McCaffrey and using time. So that
and,
was
and, yeah, he definitely underused him, I think, especially in that third quarter, I think.
Yes.
He definitely did that. But, you know, if you think conservatively, that, I mean, if you think he's being conservative, then you would expect him to run more, right? But he doesn't for some reason. That's a good point. Maybe he tries to get cute, just up-leveling that. Maybe that's his problem. Maybe he tries to get cute in big situations, right? That could be a weakness.
Because other things, right, I mean, get too very specific into player performances, right? I was reading the following day or the day after that, you know, how do you not scheme for Kittle like you do, for, like other teams do for Sam LaPorta or Kelsey and so on. Kelsey's, I think, a completely different beast. Not in terms of who he is as a player, but him and Mahomes have reached, in my mind at least, a Montana Rice, you know, Brady Gronk type of equation. But even otherwise, but to me, those are individual player performance related niggles or question marks that you can. I just think overall from a game management is where Kyle Shanahan ends up, you know, coming up short in the second half of these big games. And in all honesty, Arvind, I thought he got lucky in the Detroit game because that was something the Lions just, you know, that was a game totally let go by the Lions.
I know. They just gave it to the Warriors. I mean, not the Warriors, the Niners.
Niners.
But, you know, going back to the Super Bowl, I thought he made a huge mistake going with the ball. I think we talked about it offline in the overtime.
Yes.
But then and then after hearing to his explanation, I have been a little bit less, you know, sure about that, because the problem seems to be that, you know, back in the day, you always wanted it first, right? Now, that's not the case, we think. But really, now it just turned to you always want it third, right? Basically, you are not going to get it third unless you get it first. So assuming you score and Mahomes scores the same number of points, you again need to have the chance for a walk-off, right?
Yeah.
So long story short, watching it live, I was really convinced he should have gone second. But later, after hearing all this analytics and explanation, I am as confused as probably he was.
So,
but more importantly, Ravi, I think the whole overtime system is flawed.
It is.
But finish your thought, and I want to take it on a slightly different rules tangent, if we can, for a minute.
Yeah, definitely. So, Arvind, my second point, right, or the second piece where I think he screwed up was exactly what you said, which is his overtime decision. And I still kind of hold on to my soapbox point on this, which is that in the way the new rules are, the value that the team going second gets is that they have to almost mandatorily use all four, or they know that they have four downs to get 10 yards.
That's no the big human thing against the college overtime rule, right? As far as it looks, the reality is there's a huge advantage to going second.
Absolutely, because the thing is, no team in its psyche or no human being who's a decision maker in their psyche would feel that when they are going first and they are, let's say, 3 yards short or you know, 4 yards short of a first down after three downs, you don't get yourself to get into the psyche of saying that, no, we have the ability or we have to use all four downs. When you're going second, it's no longer a choice. You have to, if you have to score as many as the team that scored first. So to me, that's a big advantage. And to me, that is bolstered by the fact that if it was a not a game situation in their, you know, practice sessions, I am sure these teams, 99 times out of 100, convert 10 yards in three downs. My point is the game situation adds a lot more from a psychological, I mean, you know, effect perspective. And that's the part that you're completely unraveling when you're going second, that you're saying, screw the crowd, screw the tension. Yeah. Candidly, I have nothing to lose here. I mean, I have to go for it on fourth down. And to me, that's the biggest advantage to your point. And that's the reason why I thought it was a solid screw up by him not to go second.
That's my thinking too. I would also still shade a little bit about going second in those situations. And did you hear Andy Reid apparently was going to go for 2-2 as well? So did you hear that? Like if it was, let's say, Purdy has... Yeah, that is very interesting. And that kind of makes Shani's point in some sense, right? So apparently since this training camp in the summer, Reid has explained this to his players, that in the playoffs where this rule comes into effect and they go second, they will go for two. If it is, if Purdy has scored a touchdown, I would have really loved to see that in a Super Bowl. If Purdy has scored a touchdown, Mahomes scores a touchdown, they were going to go for two, which is again goes back to that point, Ravi, that you don't want to give the other team the ball third. Right? Because that is again a walk-off situation. So the NFL is really, with this rule, just punted the original problem from the first drive being, you can end it with a field goal, to now the third drive. So they have made it slightly better, but they have really not made it too much better. So Cook, I think Shani probably was not going to go for two. That's why he took the ball. Reed's strategy is, of course, if you have Mahomes, I can also be that aggressive, right?
Yeah.
He was going to go for two, which brings me back to this old thing, Ravi. I think the problem really is, and all of these rules are screwed up, including the college ones, right? I think I understand it's a physical sport. They may need to go to like a soccer type situation where it's just a timed OT. Just play 15 minutes and then go into a stupid like a field goal bake-off or something like that, right? Which I know it will be a horrible way to end a Super Bowl or any game, but I think they just need to go to a timed scenario. What do you think?
Yeah, and you know, that would also stay true to how fundamentally the game is structured, right? Where you have 60 minutes and doesn't matter whether one team gets five offensive possessions and the other team gets two. So it's up to your defense to hold the other team's offense. Time is the only constant, right? 15 minutes per quarter and play four quarters. So why not also treat the overtime the same way? To your point, exactly like how soccer is. I love that point that you made. I think right now, the way they have it, they have messed it up on both sides, which is they do have time as a constant, which is, you know, the game keeps going on until both teams have equal number of possessions. So even, you know, you cannot even say that, oh, we need to score. Like, you know, the question that one of our friends asked after the Super Bowl as to why Reed wasn't being more urgent in their possession, because there was the game didn't end at the end of the quote unquote quarter in overtime. It would have gone on.
That's funny you say that. I was totally confused by that too, watching it live. I'm like, what's going on? So what was it? They will just switch sides and keep going? I don't know what
keep going.
Was going to
keep
happen.
So the constant in the new rules is equal number of possessions rather than time. And I think that is almost like a, you know, the worst of both, trying to both two ends of the spectrum. One is, I think teams need to get a fair chance to score, and the other side is you need to keep time as a constant. In this case, they've done kind of a muddle of unhealthy muddle of both, where they're saying we can keep playing endlessly as long as both teams get equal number of chances, and we'll find out who scores less or who scores more. I think that's almost stupid.
Yeah. They need to do something, but it's a tough problem, I think, given how physical the sport is. Anyway, well, that was a good conversation on Super Bowl. I thought it was going to be short, but we got into some interesting things. Let's jump on to the league that is in season right now, which is the NBA. What are your larger thoughts on the Suns' season so far? Given both of us are from Arizona State, we have a lot of affinity to Phoenix Suns, and now we live in the Bay Area. So the Suns, I feel like, Ravi, are unfortunately pretty mediocre, especially if one of the big three are not playing.
Yeah,
I don't like a lot of things I see. Their record is decent, and I think they'll be in a good spot. I think I would really be shocked if they drop out of the top six into play-in, even though it's all bunched up in the West. West is crazy, by the way. But I feel like their depth is shaky, their defense is shaky. When one of the three are not playing, which is pretty much 90% of the season so far, I don't think they are going to do much damage. So hopefully all three are healthy, which basically means hopefully Bradley Beal is back and healthy. Otherwise, I feel like they're not going to do real damage this year. What are your assessment of them so far and moving forward?
Yeah, I share your sentiment in terms of the fact that they need all three of them and all three of them playing, you know, not on restricted minutes, etc., to really be even, I would say, good consistently. And I'm saying consistently if you just do it from the frame of reference of a playoff series, right? A best of seven playoff series. Is there a game they can steal without one of the, you know, one of their big three playing? I don't think so. I mean, given the way the West is, I think literally anyone that ends up in the top 10, including the play-in, I would not consider any of those teams a shoe-in win for the Suns in a series if the big three are not all playing together or not all playing and playing well. To me, the disappointing fact there, Arvind, is I think they should not need, given the rest of, I'm not talking about the depth, you know, in its entirety, but the combination of what you are promised when you get a Frank Vogel, you know, that defense will be tight at all times, you know, if nothing else, if you don't have your big three, at least you can be, you know, you can be confirmed that your defense will kind of be tight. And you have enough bench players who can hit open shots, which should come even if two of the top three are playing, right? You should have the Eric Gordons and the Grayson Allens and the Royce O'Neals to be hitting outside shots consistently.
Right.
I think even those things have been patchy. There are some games, like the one against the Lakers, where it looked like they could beat anyone. And then there are games against the, like, you know, the last couple of games against the Rockets, they've been very up and down. Which brings me to my second point, which is, there has not been even a single game, literally not even a single game all season where they've had four good quarters. I mean, I know the story in the national media is about how the Suns are the worst fourth quarter team. To me, it's not that. It is the substitution patterns, specifically around when Booker sits, that has directly resulted in them literally having a nosedive in those moments. And you cannot have that when, you know, you have two other people called Durant and Beal who are supposed to be on your team.
Exactly. And Durant is spectacular. His numbers are great. But I feel like he has lost something.
He has.
Right? I cannot put a finger on this, but I feel like he's just not who he used to be, especially in late in games. And I feel like, you know, Booker is the man. Actually, that kind of started shifting even last playoffs, I think.
Yeah.
But they also do this my turn, your turn thing, where whoever is hot gets to keep the ball and the other guy is pretty useless, right? Standing in the corner.
Yes.
So that is another problem, right?
So the second point you made to me may frankly be the root cause for the first point you made. Which is, again, I cannot base this on confirmed facts, so you can help me on this. But see, even at his best, and I agree with you about the overall point of Durant probably being maybe 60% of what he used to be, but even at his best, he's always had a playmaker on his team, right? He's had a Westbrook or a Harden or then, of course, Curry on his team. And Durant's been supreme, but the primary difference I have always felt between him and LeBron is that Durant is a little iffy with the ball in his hands at all times. Like, you know, and so that's one problem. Like, the part that's been frustrating for me when I see Durant during his down games is he seems very, unreliable with the ball in his hands. He gets the ball stolen. He gets the ball batted down. Too many things happen which shouldn't happen with his, you know, height and size and skill. On top of it, this is where I come back to my disappointment with Vogel. I feel there is no scheming to get one of them to run consistent screens with the other on the floor. It feels like if they are doing ISO ball, they literally take turns and the other guy is frankly completely useless, right? I see, candidly, in the last 2 weeks, I see Royce O'Neal being far more active without the ball than either Durant or Booker when one of the other has the ball in his hands. It feels like it's assumed that the guy with the ball is going to get the shot or create a shot unless something absolutely catastrophic happens.
Exactly. So it may very well be just ego and these guys not doing all it takes, right? This is where my respect for Curry has gone even higher. Because one of the things Zach Lowe, the ESPN broadcaster, keeps talking about with the Milwaukee Bucks, right, is how he was expecting a lot of Giannis Dame pick and rolls.
Uh-huh.
And he's not seeing that many, right? Now, one of the reasons apparently is these stars don't like to screen, which is kind of funny for me that apparently even Giannis, who's a big guy, right? Big guys usually do screen.
Yeah.
But he considers himself more as like a Durant type, right? He can dribble the ball. He can go coast to coast and all that. Maybe it's because, I don't know why, but apparently he doesn't like to screen. Dame is the guy with the ball his entire career. Apparently he doesn't like to screen, right? And I'm thinking it's one of those, you know, star culture thing more than anything. Like, you cannot ask Booker or Durant to consistently screen for the other guy. It's just...
yeah.
Ego and all of that stuff, right? So you got to bring in somebody like the Royce O'Neal or somebody to do the dirty work, and then the other guy just stands in the corner. And you contrast that to the Warriors. It is just amazing how many times Curry screens for freaking Kuminga, who's like a third-year guy.
Right.
And every single time two people stick with Curry, and either Draymond or Kuminga or somebody gets a wide-open lane, right? That's the whole famous 4-on-3 play. They've been running with Draymond for 10 years now.
Yes.
But now they do that with Kuminga. And with Kuminga, he's not the same passer, but he's a way better finisher. So he just gets to the hoop half the time unimpeded, right? And we talk about this movement of the ball ad nauseum with Curry and Clay. But Curry also screens. And I think for a small guy, that's probably not even easy on his body, right?
Yes.
Because he's screening like big dudes and all of that. But to me, Ravi, those are the things I think you need to do to win, right?
100%,
And I think a Booker Durant pick and roll, if they run it like 15 times a game, would be fantastic, I think. And to your point, they also need a playmaker, no question. The question is whether Bradley Beal can fill some of that role. Actually, Booker has been decent in that role this year. But can Bradley Beal share the load and he can do some of that? That's the question.
That was going to be my, you know, with that being said, is it all doom and gloom? And I was thinking of three things which make me still feel kind of confident. And one of them was going to be that in the limited time that the three of them have been together, and within that, in the even more limited time that you see Beal initiating the offense, right? He playing playmaker. I actually think that the offense has run quite smoothly, because at the end of the day, at some point in time, talent wins, right? Talent wins over any scheme, any defensive pressure. And if you have Beal running the offense, bringing the ball up to the top of the key, and you have Durant and Booker, and if they are in their quote-unquote good game where they are moving around without the ball, I think the Suns offense is indefensible, whatever you call it, right? I mean, it is potent. The problem has been we haven't literally had Beal even at 50% capacity most of the game. There's always some niggle or the other. But otherwise, I hear you. In terms of which also really quick, the second point I was going to make, and again, this goes into the whole screen setter conversation. I have felt super happy about the Nurkic experience so far. And I always compare it to what it would have been if we had Ayton instead of Nurkic. And I know Nurkic has his own like awful games, but by far, he's been a you know, just in terms of two things, right? Being more secure with the ball and in setting screens, I think Nurkic has done a lot of the work that we hadn't seen in the last 5 years in a Suns uniform by anyone.
Right. That has worked out. But even Grayson Allen has worked out, I would say.
Yeah. You know, and he's one of those guys, Arvind, who I feel if he's not on your team, you hate the sight of him. Right. And if he plays for you, you kind of, you know, become a fan of his.
Yeah. But still, I think where they are in the standing is just about right for them. And hopefully they can change that in the playoffs. Yeah.
You know, what's fascinating to me, and I wouldn't put money on this, even though it gladdens my heart, is that if you look at the latest, betting odds, the Suns have the fifth, strongest odds to win the championship after the Celtics, Nuggets, Clippers, and Bucks. I cannot believe that they have better odds to win than the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Minnesota Timberwolves. Candidly, to me, those two teams, even the Knicks and the Cavs, I feel, more, secure about them than I do about the Suns. But I guess the bettors know something we don't.
Right. I think I wonder if one of the problems is those teams are more likely to run into Lakers and the Warriors because they are in the the lower half, right? In the very first round.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure if these two teams will be able to beat them, but there is that fear, right? Those two inexperienced team running into these experienced superstars who seem to be turning their season around. And that's interesting. And speaking of that Super Bowl where, me and a couple of friends went to Vegas, right?
Uh-huh.
We had seen this odds of the Warriors winning the championships at 80-1 on the Friday or a Saturday before the Super Bowl, right? That's the night, if you remember, Curry hit that ridiculous shot against the Suns.
Yes. Right? Yes.
So we said, this 80-1, it's good. We could put it $10, $50, whatever, and see what happens. You won't believe it. By Monday morning, it was 40-1, I think.
Right. As it stands right now.
Exactly. And surprisingly, it has not moved much since then. You're right. I just checked before the podcast. I thought it might have even moved further, but I guess they have not, Warriors have not played any contenders since then. The only contender they played was Denver. They lost. So the Lakers, even more than the Lakers, the Warriors are making a push. I wonder some of the folks are scared for the teams at the very top because of these two teams. Last year they upset, quote-unquote, upset Kings and the Grizzlies, right? But I do believe, to your point, both the Thunder and Wolves are way better than last year's Grizzlies and Kings. But still, would we really be shocked if the Lakers or Warriors upset them? I don't think so. Whereas at least Suns are in the lower half, so maybe they won't meet Warriors or Lakers until much later, even if that's a concern. Plus, Suns have Durant, right? So they get experience points for that too. Yeah,
I think the Durant factor is the biggest, needle mover as far as the, the bettors, or for that matter, analysts and experts still looking at the Suns as a top five, chances to win potential. It just doesn't feel that way when you watch their games day in and day out. He doesn't seem to have the same step as he used to. But again, as I said, I hope that we don't know as much as the analysts and the bettors do about what the Suns are.
Absolutely. So before we hang up, Ravi, we need to talk about one of our favorites getting his jersey retired tonight at the Suns game, Amari Stoudemire, Stat.
Yes.
He, I think, continues to be one of the most impressive athletes, pure athletes I've ever seen on a basketball court. That's saying a lot, right, considering how great the average NBA athlete is, let alone the top of the line guys are. But I just miss those days with Nash and Amari. Peak Amari was something else, Ravi. Any yes. thoughts you want to share on that?
Couldn't agree more with you, Arvind. And I was, before this pod, we were talking about this as a topic, as a potential topic we would discuss. And I was just trying to aggregate my thoughts on what was it that I thought made him made him such a beast. And it starts from the basic point that the NBA was very different back then. And, you know, back then is what, a decade ago, than it is today. There are quite a lot of players in that size and strength zone playing multiple different ways today. But the time at which Amari really excelled was a time where basketball was still very old school. Offense was run very, very methodically, very meticulously. You needed basically a point guard to run your offense. You needed a back to the basket center, you know, to get into the paint. And he kind of destroyed all those stereotypes, both in terms of you know, his physical skills, but also what he brought to a team that was a disruptor in the NBA of the time. You know, we've talked ad nauseum about the 7 seconds or less Phoenix Suns and what they did to the NBA, to the future of the NBA. I think other than Nash, Amari was the most important cog in the wheel in making the 7 seconds or less Suns what they became.
Of course, and two
examples that I specifically think of is, we talked about, you know, setting screens earlier in this conversation. I don't think I've seen a better role, you know, the screen and roll, the roll man than Amari. The Nash Amari screen and rolls were a joy to kind of watch, whether you're a Suns fan or not. So that is something
best,
right?
Yeah, that was the best. Yeah,
best. And obviously it helped that he was also one of the best, if not the best finisher. So when you are rolling off and you have someone like a Nash who can find geometric angles with which 99% of other point guards cannot, and you are a great finisher, it was no wonder that the team was as good as executing on those offensive sets as they were. That was one. The second thing was, I mean, if you look back at that first, if I'm not wrong, the first playoff series of that era, that where they lost to the Spurs, I think 4-2, right. But he gave Tim Duncan hell. And Tim Duncan is recognized as one of the, if not the best defender of his time. And I think Amari was one of the ones who really made him work hard.
Yes, and that was kind of when people really took note of him, and it was the whole thing, oh, these guys are coming, the Suns are coming, right? Because they, absolutely right, I was going to go there as well, by the way. They lost the series, but he was unstoppable. He was literally unstoppable, even more so than Nash and others. And the other real takeoff point for him was even earlier, I believe, Ravi, that didn't he have a dunk on Michael Olowokandi?
Yes, very much.
That was kind of his athletic signature, I think. But anyway,
it's interesting. It's interesting. Just one quick thing. It's interesting you say that. Even in my memory, Arvind, the Olowokandi dunk is what kind of sticks out. But the Suns have compiled this video tribute, which will obviously get aired tonight during the game. And that has about, I think, 15 or so dunks. And the recipients of the poster in that include everyone from Duncan to Robinson to Shaq to LeBron to Richard Jefferson. There is one where he ends up sitting on Richard Jefferson after a dunk. I mean, it is crazy how vicious this guy was and how many actual, you know, quote-unquote legends have ended up being posterized by him.
Yes, yes. He was sensational. He seems like an interesting guy too. Interesting personality. We don't know these guys personally, but he seems like a cool guy. Anyways, Congrats to him. It's great being on the spot again, Ravi. Anything else you want to hit before we say goodbye and hopefully reconnect soon, periodically, hopefully moving forward?
Absolutely, Arvind. So thank you again for this. I agree with you that it would be good. And again, for good or bad, let's just follow through with our Suns through the rest of the season, as well as what's happening in the NBA. So there's always topics for us to talk about, and we'll come back as frequently as we can.
Yes. Thanks, and talk to you also.
Bye. Hey, hey, hey.